Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's think tank for advancing the study of trust in institutions. Welcome to a special three-part series of The Trust Makers, recording on the ground from the 2025 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Over the next few days, we'll be speaking with media, business, and government leaders about what they're seeing at this year's annual meeting in Davos. We'll also dive into the 2025 Edelman Trust Barometer, which we just launched this week. It also marks Edelman's 25th anniversary of studying trust. I'm joined today by Kate Ryder, the founder and CEO of Maven Clinic. Kate started her career in venture capital and as a journalist, writing for The Economist and The New Yorker before founding Maven Clinic in 2014. Over the past decade, Maven has become the largest virtual clinic for women's and family health, having partnered with more than 2,000 employers and health plans across the world to cover 15 million people. Kate, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're recording this towards the middle or end of Davos week, and it's your first year in Davos. How's it going so far?
Ooh, it's been amazing. I think you don't know what to expect until you actually get here and get the lay of the land. But the energy here is frenzied. There's a million things to go to. But I think my favorite thing has just been sitting in the Congress Center and meeting people during kind of the off moments.
So you mentioned the Congress Center. What even is the Congress Center for our listeners who aren't sitting in it now?
You know, I'm not quite sure myself. I just know this is the place I show up that only certain badges get you in. And then you sit there and it's one of the best places to get a cup of coffee, find a table, get good Wi-Fi, get free lunch, and then have conversations with a million interesting people.
What types of people do you run into while you're having a coffee at the Congress Center?
Well, I just, on my way here, walked by Paul Ryan, the former congressman, and got to sit down with some of my favorite reporters at lunch. So that's pretty cool.
What has surprised you about Davos so far? That could be good, bad, ugly, all of the above?
What has surprised me actually is the speed at which people are operating here, because you can be invited to 5 to 6 events at night. No one has any qualms about just booking an event when there's a million other events. And so you're running around and having 5 to 10 minute conversations, sometimes longer when you see someone you might know. But so it's a little bit crazy in that regard. But then I will say the thing that I've learned in the last 2 days is that a lot of the best stuff happens at night, because then everyone's kind of lets their hair down, they're done with their meetings, and they're a little bit more uncensored.
And when you say the best stuff, describe the best stuff.
I think just real honest conversation on how people are really feeling.
Yeah.
I was at a panel earlier, and I forget because it is, quite frankly, all a blur. There's so much content here, but someone made, and it was the moderator, made the point that when you did a poll in the room, everyone's pessimistic, and yet all these speakers show up at Davos optimistic, because you're supposed to be optimistic when you speak publicly, but then secretly people are answering these polls that they're not optimistic. And so that's, I think, what is so interesting. And then when you really can kind of let your hair down at the end of the day and talk to major business executives or politicians, you hear what's really on their mind.
And so based on those late night conversations, the coffees in the Congress Center, one thing that's clear is you said that it sounds like people are putting on a fairly optimistic front publicly. Behind the scenes, also optimistic, a little more guarded, pessimistic?
I think it depends. I mean, I think in general, probably to be a business leader, you have to be inherently optimistic, because you're constantly planning for a future that you think is probably going to be better than the past. But I think there's a lot of issues in the world today, and not every CEO wants to talk about them publicly. I understand that. I feel the same way. But you can talk about some of the real issues, you know, in the background over Negronis.
For sure. And look, one of the findings of the Trust Barometer that we just released this week is the correlation between optimism and trust building and the importance for business leaders to help build optimism, but it's got to be legitimate. It can't be some PR thing. It's actually got to be based on actions and real progress. Speaking of actions and real progress, you founded Maven Clinic in 2014, not that long ago. Can you tell our listeners a bit about Maven Clinic and what you offer and what led you to found it?
Sure. And we're Edelman is a client. We're thrilled. So I, 10 years ago, I had just recently turned 30 and I didn't have kids yet, but I was looking down the decade that was to come knowing that I would have kids. I now have three. Some of my friends were starting to have kids for the first time. And what was so fascinating and disturbing and shocking while working in venture capital is to see friends of mine, get postpartum depression and not have it be treated, suffer from infertility and not have the money to cover IVF services beyond one cycle. And today, this particular friend only has one kid. She probably could have had three if she was having kids today. And so to see all of the gaps in care that women were facing, and then meanwhile, to work in venture capital, digital health, and see that women dominate healthcare as the core consumer. Women are really important as a healthcare constituent, and yet there were so many gaps in the women's healthcare model. And so that's the motivation behind Maven. And over the last 10 years, as we've grown and continued to peel back the onion on the gaps, I can't even tell you how motivated I am. And I feel like we're only like 5% of the way into our journey.
Based on your results, I can guess that you've been quite successful explaining your value proposition to corporate leaders. But what have been some of the barriers to making sure that people understand your value and the need for what you offer?
Sure. So there's so many different stakeholders that we work with. We work with investors, we work with providers, we work with health plans, we work with companies, and then of course we work with members. And everyone has an opinion about women's health and healthcare more broadly. And almost everybody has had a negative experience in healthcare. And so I think one of the most important things for us is we've kind of unpacked how do we talk about our business to all of these different stakeholders, and our value prop is really about meeting them where they are. And so just to kind of level set on what our platform does, we both deliver virtual care. So we're a clinic in your pocket, so to speak. You can talk to a pediatrician or an OBGYN or a lactation consultant within 10 minutes. I use it all the time for my three kids. But then we also design the financial benefits. So we design IVF benefits, doula reimbursement benefits, sometimes backup childcare benefits for companies. So in that sense, we are a new type of care model with aligned incentives towards the patient and always doing what's right by him or her. And we're also virtual. So we're just very modern, very convenient. And what's really exciting after 10 years is we drive real outcomes with this model. So whether it's efficiency of IVF cycles, so getting a baby in someone's hands as quickly as possibly and affordably as possibly, or helping maternal health outcomes on driving C-section rates down. But anyways, going back to your question of how do we describe our value prop, a provider is going to have a very different point of view than an employer. And so with providers, it's real. The providers know immediately because the providers have all of these anxious patients coming into their offices. Patients are on TikTok. Patients are on Google. They are getting more and more misinformation than they've ever gotten. And yet their appointments with their providers are getting shorter and shorter. So if you have an OBGYN who's treating a pregnant woman, that pregnant woman is going in once a month for 10 minutes, and OB doesn't want to be talking about misinformation for 10 minutes like that, or talking about low acuity things. And so that's a lot of what we can handle over telemedicine. Really what the patient should be doing is talking about the most important things and the highest risk things with their in-person doctor. So that's one thing. On the client side, however, they care as much about healthcare as they do about gender equity in the workforce and economic empowerment and the wage gap between men and women and making sure that we are taking care of our future female leaders. So it's very different. This women's health touches everything.
You mentioned the telemedicine component of what you offer. One of the findings that we've had in the Trust Barometer is skepticism of new innovations, and it's kind of split amongst respondents, particularly around AI, those who embrace it and then those who are a little bit more skeptical of it. I would imagine just in the decade or so since you've begun the company, you've probably seen some changes around telemedicine and new innovations in health that you roll out. I wonder what some of what you observe is around the adoption of new innovations.
Well, COVID was an example where a lot of people didn't know what telehealth was, and then all of a sudden everyone started using telehealth overnight. And I just remember so many doctors at the time admitted that they were telemedicine skeptics. And then the second they were forced to use it, they realized, oh my gosh, I actually can have calm,
visits with my patients. I can see inside their homes. Like, I can't do everything over telemedicine, but it's so value add, and I'm getting to actually help and treat my patients more and more. So that was a very validating kind of series of months, as a lot of doctors came forward and said, actually, this is a really important technology in digital health, which seems so obvious to us 10 years ago. And, you know, to the postpartum new mom, she doesn't want to leave her house to ask the doctor a question if she can do it over the phone. That's so obvious. But it took that COVID forcing some providers to do it for them to kind of adopt it. And I think AI is the same way.
Well, it also feels like an innovation that more than many others, you really experience as a patient, and you can easily see the value, even though it might have taken something as awful as the pandemic for the adoption rates to really pick up.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think people inherently don't like change. And so every time there's a new innovation, there's always risks. But I think that broad adoption, you have to kind of push through the skepticism in the beginning. And I think AI is in exactly the same spot. There's, of course, major risks. But particularly from what we're seeing, I mean, healthcare needs AI. Healthcare is such a broken industry.
Well, you talk about healthcare as a broken industry. Right now, there are a number of people, as our report found, with grievances against all institutions, including business. And they're feeling that business is not helping regular people in terms of their financial interests. They have fears about inflation, job loss, automation that are really breeding this sense of grievance. Many feel the wealthy are benefiting unfairly from the system. As someone working particularly in the health space, do you have a sense yourself of this grievance? Is it something you've been observing, have observed before?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the grievance played out at a national level with the horrific assassination of Brian Thompson. And that really, all of the commentary that occurred on social media afterwards, which was also pretty horrific to see, was exactly what you're talking about. It was a lot of the grievances. So healthcare, I think, is one of the industries that has historically the lowest consumer trust, because at the basic level, it just doesn't work. And, you know, even if you have the best healthcare plan, you have the most concierge medicine, you still can't read your healthcare bill. You don't know how much things cost. For most people in America, you can't book a doctor's appointment within weeks, let alone months sometimes. You never know anymore whether you're walking into a doctor's office or a dentist's office and they want to do things because they want to drive profits up or because it's actually what you need as a patient. With all of the new technologies coming online, patients are often left to advocate for themselves. So you hear so many stories of patients who have gone to a doctor because, unfortunately, healthcare just depends on the quality of doctor you have right now. And they go to a doctor and they don't get the care. And then they're having to go deep on, you know, the internet, talking to other patients to just be their own advocate. And so there's so much that can be done, both on the basic practical level of logistics and access and getting appointments and financial transparency, but then also, you know, from a quality standpoint, we've got to build a system where people are sharing data and that data is helping better inform patient care at scale.
Our own Health Trust report really looks at the same thing that you observe, which is that people often trust their friends in doing their own research as much as they trust doctors. What are you doing at Maven to address some of the issues you talked about? You mentioned costs, you mentioned transparency, you mentioned quality of care, but also I kind of heard something about almost like access to useful information.
Yeah, everything. So I was a journalist, as you said. One of the first things I did when I started Maven is I interviewed my uncle. My uncle is a cardiologist and my grandfather was a cardiologist. And I have another uncle who's also a cardiologist. So lots of cardiologists in my family. And so this was 11 years ago. And 11 years ago, he said, the difference between me practicing medicine today and observing my father is that back in the day, doctors used to make house calls and they were part of people's families. And so when my grandfather died, 500 people went to his funeral in Chicago because he was their beloved doctor who they trusted, who was part of the family. My uncle said now, you know, he's based in Arizona and he feels like people think he's just looking to make a buck. And so this is where there's just such an erosion and such a difference in how doctors are viewed in the U.S. today. And so what we're doing on Maven to combat a lot of this is, first of all, we're operating in an industry like women's health, which has been so underfunded, underserved. that there's just really low-hanging fruit. So first principles, we have the largest telemedicine network in women's and family health. We have over 30 different types of providers operating across fertility, pregnancy, pediatrics, and menopause. And you can talk to any of these providers. You can seek out providers who look like you, who speak your same language, who are your same race, who are your same gender, and you can ask them any question you want. And I think when I look at so many of our member testimonials, so many people are having such high quality interactions with providers on Maven because they're so specialized in treating what they're looking for. And so you can't just roll up to any OBGYN today and expect them to know how to treat you if you're going through menopause or you're in perimenopause. On Maven, we have providers tagged in our system to say, hey, this person has been trained in menopause or has a lot of experience with menopause patients. They can write you an HRT prescription and they can talk to you. And so there's that huge difference. I mean, you would think this is a tag in regular pricks and mortar care, but it's not. I mean, the amount of women who are in perimenopause who are showing up to their OBs today and just aren't getting any care. And then they use Maven, a virtual clinic, and they just talk to someone for 10 minutes, get a prescription, and they feel seen and they feel heard. That's incredible. So that's an example. On the payment side, one of the things that we started to see in the fertility industry is that fertility, which doesn't necessarily need to look like the rest of healthcare with non-transparent claims, it's a bundled cost. You're going through a cycle, you pay one cost, that the industry was starting to tip into that. And so as an example, drug prices in fertility have risen by 84% in the last 10 years versus other medication, which on average is about 40%. So something is rotten here. So for us, what we did is we just made a very transparent benefit where we have negotiated rates with drug companies, negotiated rates with clinics, and we do not take markups, and we're very transparent about what those rates are. Instead, we invest a lot in technology. And so because we're a technology company, we can actually provide a more scalable experience. We don't have to spend so much money and try to eke profit out in these other ways because we're built on a stronger foundation in the first place.
Well, I love that so much of what your platform seems to do is connect people with the right person for their need. And the type of transparency and clarity that you're talking about, as opposed to that really long bill that's confusing, is certainly something that is trust building. We found that 65% of the people who have high levels of grievance said that leaders can earn legitimate influence with them if the leaders understand what people need and want. And it sounds like that's very much up the alley of what we've been talking about today. As a leader, how do you earn influence?
I think one of the things that's really important to us is we have to work with the system, not against it, to create systemic change. And so we need to identify what are all the ways that we can stay true to our mission of providing better access to care and putting the patient first and delivering truly on what the patient needs, and partner with a system that sometimes doesn't always have the right incentives. And so that's been something as an innovator, it's showing partnership and showing all the ways that we're stronger together and we can help a health plan, a health system, a drug company achieve their objectives while also achieving ours, which are very pure in the sense that it's all about getting better patient outcomes, getting patients better access to care. As a leader at Maven and as a leader of a company that is now hybrid, that has grown a lot over the past few years, communication is so important. And so I actually still spend a lot of my time thinking about how to make sure that every single person at Maven knows exactly what their goals are, how their goals ladder up to our company goals, how those goals ladder up to our mission, and just repeating that over and over and over again, because I can't emphasize enough, like it is, there's so much that goes on day to day in a high growth company and in healthcare. You just have to constantly simplify and constantly bring people back to, you know, this is the most important thing, and this is what we have to do.
I love that idea of simple and clear communications. Your background as a journalist, has it informed how you think of the communications part of your role as CEO?
Yeah, you know, I think at year 10, one of the things that's very clear is as a CEO, and there's so many different types of CEO, I'm a certain type of CEO, you lean into your strengths, and then you have an amazing team that complements kind of your weaknesses. And so one of my strengths is obviously communicating, storytelling, writing, sales, marketing, describing the Maven value proposition in very clear terms, connecting with audiences. And so that is definitely a place where I spend a lot of my time. And I am so happy to have an incredible COO, an incredible CFO, just help scale some of the operations we have as a technology and services business.
And look, now you're on the other side of media interviews. Does your background as a journalist also inform how you engage with media?
Yes and no. I think because I'm a journalist, like I'm not going to BS you. I'm just going to withhold things if I don't want to say them, but I'm not going to say anything that's not true. And so that's been really important to me with our comms team, with, you know, with everything I say ever to the company as a leader or to clients or to members. We can never say things that we don't believe or that we aren't true. And so at the highest level, like if the patient isn't our North Star, we can't say it's our North Star. And if they are our North Star, then everything we do has to subscribe to that notion. And so in that sense, our business model is informed by our mission and our story and what we're trying to do in the world. I can't say that if we really mess something up, I'm not going to say we did a great job. I'm going to say, guys, we can do better than this. And so I think that, you know, that direct style has benefited me as a leader.
I think that direct style is also something that the media probably really appreciates. And for us at the Trust Institute, we often look at how different institutions can work together to build trust. And business has relatively high trust, media lower trust. How can media and business collaborate more and actually build more trusted relationships and really lift the tide for all boats?
Yeah, listen, I think when I was a journalist, I always looked at my relationships with my sources or with executives as a long game. So if I was reporting a story and someone said something and then they were like, oh, I don't want you to say that, I would find a way to get the truth out there without throwing that person under the bus because I would want to build a long-term relationship. Same with if there was something like silly that was, you know, that was tabloid worthy, I wouldn't go after that. You know, you're playing the long game. And so I think that one of the things that's been now so interesting being on the other side of that, there was a really interesting op-ed in the New York Times, I think in the last week, about how attention is the biggest currency now. It's not fame, it's not money. It's the fact that if you have a mass audience on TikTok, on X, on any of these social platforms, and people know your story and they know your authentic story, that is one of the most important things. I mean, you look at Trump, you look at Elon Musk, and that is what they are both so good at. And so I think business and media can absolutely collaborate in this way. But I've seen great journalists. I've also seen younger journalists chasing petty stories. I'm like, why would you do that? You know, but I think there is something to be said where journalists can still put out the truth and still kind of stay true to their principles while also recognizing that it's a long game and also what CEOs are now and business executives are under pressure for. Like, I don't enjoy tweeting, let's be honest.
Well, I was smiling when you were talking about social media because one of the ways that the forum has evolved is we're taping this podcast in essentially what's called the Media Center. And 5 years ago, there wasn't a podcast booth. Now we're sitting here in a podcast booth. Right now, I'm looking right across from us and I see the creator studio that they have for YouTube right across from us. So you really see it's almost being manifest here at the forum where you see some of these evolutions of even the types of media that the types of corporate folks that attend Davos want to connect with.
Yeah, no, it's important to get our story out, to get our brand out. But it is like, you know, a CEO has so many other things going on that if I had the time and space to just do this all day, I probably would like it more. But when you don't have the time and space to do anything, you know, as a CEO often, and you're just doing a million things. And so that's why, yes, that partnership is so important.
Well, but also I love what you said before, like you have to know yourself and what your strengths are. Because by the way, like most other CEOs sitting across the chair from me would not say that the communications part of their role is their favorite. Most, even those that are really good at it, are like, yeah, I get it. It's something I need to do. I see that it's important for the company, but there are other things I like doing more. There's some who are in your category. I think a lot of it is knowing yourself as well. You mentioned doing a million things at once. And at the beginning of this conversation, you talked about the frenzy of Davos. So to close, I'd love your tip to other leaders. What do you do to recharge? Like, are you able to just do the million things at once? Are you able to just go through the frenzy and it's fine? Or are there things that you do just as a human, as a leader, to help recharge yourself or keep yourself being able to be focused during all the frenzy?
Sure. I think I'm an extrovert. So I'm sure extroverts find Davos a little bit easier than introverts do. But I still need those few hours in the middle of the day to kind of go into my dark room and read. I'm reading about the news of the day. Sometimes if I'm reading a book, I'll read that book. But I just need to get outside my little bubble and see what's going on in the rest of the world. And then I can kind of dip back in. But I definitely need my quiet time.
Even extroverts need their moments. Kate, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us at The Trustmakers. And to our listeners, this is the end of our Davos week. We appreciate you tuning in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.